Good afternoon. Put me in my place. I want to take a moment to thank so many of you who had a hand in helping to prepare and organize everything for this day. Those who were involved in the music this morning, the guitar duet and the choir this afternoon. I certainly always enjoy and appreciate the music that we have, and now we do know another hymn. We can work on that a little bit more. The flowers are beautiful up here today as well. I want to thank whoever was responsible for providing those for us. Of course, there's always a lot of work to prepare the room, set it up, so that we can all just come in and sit down and be comfortable. So thank you to all of you who are part of that. And what can we say about the snacks? Makes you want to wish the days of unleavened bread weren't over. But I've really enjoyed all the special effort again that's gone into today to make it a very enjoyable time for us all. But it is the last day of unleavened bread. And tonight, the leaven comes home to roost. Tomorrow you can have toast for breakfast, have a sandwich for lunch, have a big old piece of chocolate cake for dessert after you finish your broccoli. You've been eating unleavened bread now for a week, nearly, another few hours, and this time will come to its conclusion. And I don't know, maybe some of you have found it challenging. Maybe there have been some embarrassing slip-ups. Maybe there have been some times when you really missed having the food that we normally have that is leavened. But after we've observed this week a few times, we find ways to make it work, and it really does not seem at all to be a burden. In fact, again, with those snacks in mind that we've had today, much of what we have during this week is really a real treat, and it's very enjoyable. I don't think the days of unleavened bread are intended to be a burden, but it's just different. And it's something that we have to prepare for and something we have to keep in the front of our minds all week long so we don't make any mistakes. So we're coming to the end. Why have we done this? What has been the point of our observance of this week in such an unusual way? And now that it's almost over, what comes next? What do we do now? Let's begin in Exodus, the 13th chapter. Exodus 13. We find here a summary that helps us remember, as it was taught to Israel, why we do this, why we observe this week in its special and somewhat unusual way. Exodus 13 will begin in verse 3. It says that Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place." That's really pretty much the key right there. Remember what happened. Remember what just took place. That the Eternal brought you out of bondage, and you brought you out of that slavery. "No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you are going out in the month of Abib, and it shall be when the Eternal brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and Amorites, Hivites and Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month." So it's to be observed continually, observed from year to year, for the sake of remembering what happened, remembering what God did for Israel. Verse 7, "Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, 'This is done because of what the Eternal did for me when I came up out of Egypt.'" Each generation was to continue to be taught what happened. It is interesting, I think, if you glance ahead through the scripture, that the Exodus from Egypt is something that is reviewed and we're reminded of all the way to the end of the Bible. Even in the book of Jude, you find a reference to Israel coming out of Egypt and being rescued from that bondage. Egypt is mentioned as a symbol of sin in the book of Revelation. So this was to be taught from one generation to the next. Here's what we do. Here's why we do it. Here's what happened way back at the very beginning. There are so many stories, so much to learn about what happened. One of the most exciting stories in all of Scripture is how God began to work in Egypt to bring Egypt to its knees and then to bring Israel out and through the Red Sea and into the wilderness. It's an exciting time, and it's something that's, in a sense, easy to teach to our children. It's a story that they enjoy learning. These are historic events that are to be taught and remembered by every generation. Verse 9, it shall be a sign to you on your hand and a memorial between your eyes, that the Eternal's law may be in your mouth. This celebration is to be both a sign and a memorial. There's a difference between the two. A sign is a distinguishing mark or a banner or a reminder. We see signs all around. Street signs are a good example. They're out there on the roads, and if you travel the same route often, you probably don't notice them anymore. But they're telling you what road you're on, how far it is to the next city or exit, and it helps you to be oriented to where you are and how long it's going to take you to be wherever you're headed. Many years ago, my wife and I lived in a rural area, and all the roads had names, at least according to the map, but most of them did not have a street sign. And it made it really challenging, especially late at night in an area, or after dark, in an area that we didn't know, trying to find someone's home. We'd get directions such as, go down the main road and turn left where that old red barn used to be. Okay. Or, you'll know when you're coming close to our house because there's this field with a bunch of horses in it. There were lots of fields, and we just hoped the horses would be there as we approached their home. But signs are important. The Days of Unleavened Bread are a sign. They're a mile marker or a marker, an indicator on your road of life as to where you are, what you're doing, what you're learning, where you're headed. It assures you that you're on the right path, that you're going the right direction. A memorial, a little bit different. A memorial is a reminder of the covenant. It's a very specific word in the Hebrew. It means a reminder of the covenant or of the covenant's name of God. For example, in Exodus chapter 3, we'll just flip back a couple of pages here quickly. Exodus chapter 3, where God introduced himself to Israel. Exodus 3:14, God said to Moses, when Moses had asked, What should I say your name is when I go back to the people? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Verse 15, moreover, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to Israel, the eternal God of your fathers, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. It's a reminder of who God is. It's another way a reason why we observe these days. It reminds of who God is and what he has done. How he rescued his people, how he established his covenant with them. So we have observed these days, in much the same way, a lot of differences as well because of the different times and cultures, but we've observed this day, at least in the sense of putting leaven out of our homes, in the very same way Israel did all those centuries, all those millennia before us, to be taught the same lesson, to be reminded of God rescuing his people. God had to teach Israel who they were and who he was and what it was going to be like to be a nation. They'd been in slavery for generations. They didn't know how to be a nation. They didn't know God. They didn't know what he expected of them. So God taught them how to be his people. That's part of what he accomplished when he brought them out. Turn to Exodus 19. Exodus 19, verse 1, says that in the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. We glance at this verse just to get kind of a benchmark as far as the passing of time. Israel had left Egypt in the middle of the first month, and now here they are at the middle of the third month, on the selfsame day, it says, on that third month of the year. So, kind of looking at the calendar, it seems very likely that it took Israel about 7 weeks to walk from Egypt to Mount Sinai. It took them about 7 weeks to reach where they had come to. And when they got there, something very important began. Turn to chapter 40. Skip ahead here. Chapter 40, verse 17. We find another benchmark that indicates the passing of time, where we are. Another sign as we go through these verses to see where we are in terms of time. Exodus 40, 17. In the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, the tabernacle was raised up. So it took them almost exactly a year. On the first month of the second year, on the first day of that month. So it would have been just 2 weeks shy of 1 year since they had kept the first Passover. Because we're to the first month in the second year, on the first day. So that tells us that what we find in between here took place over a period of about a year. It took Israel about a year for them to complete the building of the tabernacle. It was raised up on that day. Let's look at one more verse to compare here. Numbers chapter 10, verse 11. Numbers chapter 10, verse 11. It came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of the testimony, and the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys. This is about 3 weeks after the tabernacle had been completed. It's now the second month, the 20th day of the second month, still in the first year. So this gives us again a kind of a benchmark in terms of the passing of time and what was being accomplished during that time. So they remained at that location at the foot of Mount Sinai for a year. Why did God leave them there for a whole year? Well, we heard a little bit about that in the sermonette a few minutes ago. That period of isolation for the nation of Israel was important to them because during that time, they were introduced to God. During that time, they were to learn who God was. They were going to enter into a covenant relationship with him, and they would learn what they needed to know to be the people of God. It's one of the lessons that we learn during the days of unleavened bread. God is teaching us how to be his people. as he taught Israel during that period of time. During this period of time, there were explicit directions and specifics given to them in terms of how they should build the tabernacle. It was to be built to very precise and specific plans. And those plans were given to them, and they had to follow them very carefully. During that time, they learned the laws and regulations about how to follow and how to obey God. They learned how to worship God. They learned about the ceremonies, about the sacrifices, and about the days that God had set aside for them. They learned what we find recorded in the book of Leviticus. We see here that it was about a three-week period when the tabernacle was finished before they left. And between those two dates, a period of 3 weeks or so, we find tucked in here the book of Leviticus. Now, they didn't receive that information just in a three-week period, but it indicates that it was during the time they were at Mount Sinai that they were taught what we find written in Leviticus. Not a book that we look at maybe as often as some others. Not a lot of references to Leviticus in sermons. Look back through some of my own notes, and I don't see it referred to a lot. Not like maybe the book of Psalms or Proverbs or the Gospels or the epistles of Paul, the books we tend to see more of and see them more often. There are no well-known stories in the book of Leviticus. Who's the hero of the book of Leviticus? There's really no storyline in Leviticus, but it is an essentially important and vital book. We find a great deal of information about how to live and how to worship God. Let's look in Leviticus chapter 27, verse 34. We find something about this book. Leviticus 27, verse 34. The very last sentence in this book says, "These are the commandments which the Eternal commanded Moses for the children of Israel on Mount Sinai." So we see here that this instruction was given to Moses during that time he was on Mount Sinai. And when he came down, he presented the covenant to God of God to the people. And he also presented to them the instruction that's in what we find to be the book of Leviticus, teaching them how to be the nation of God. Now, it wasn't given to them as a book. Moses didn't, you know, run down to the Kinko's and make a million copies and hand them out to all the folks of Israel. It was taught to them during this period of a full year while they were there at Mount Sinai. There's a phrase used in this book. The phrase, "the Lord said to Moses," that phrase is used 33 times in the book of Leviticus. As we saw here in chapter 27, verse 34, God had delivered information to Moses, and Moses then, having received that information, that message from God, was to teach the people from that. There are a couple other places in the book of Leviticus where the same point is made, that what Moses was teaching was what he had learned on Mount Sinai. So there are two primary lessons that are emphasized throughout the book of Leviticus. First of all, God was teaching Israel that he was their God and they must obey him. He was teaching them that he is their God and they must obey him. The word Lord, or as we often read it, eternal, appears more than 300 times in the book of Leviticus. 24 times in this book, we find the phrase, "I am the Lord your God." And nearly a dozen times Israel is reminded that it was God who brought them out of Egypt. So they are repeatedly told, and it is emphasized to them over and over again, I am now your God. I am the one who brought you out of Egypt, and you are required to obey me. Secondly, so the first lesson or theme is that God was teaching them that he was their God and they must obey him. Secondly, God was teaching them that they were to become like he is. God taught them to become like he is. Now, both of these lessons are relevant and essential to us as we conclude our observance of the days of unleavened bread. As God taught them and preserved this instruction, we learn from it as well. We know who our God is and that he requires us to obey him. And we learn that we must become as he is. Look at Leviticus 19, verse 1. Leviticus 19, verse 1. The Eternal spoke to Moses. Again, if it's interesting, you can kind of page through and you can see that so many of the chapters begin with that phrase. The Eternal spoke to Moses. God gave this message to his servant, who then delivered it to the people. The Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Eternal, your God, am holy. God was teaching Israel that they must become like him. That God was special and separate, unique from all other beings who were worshipped. He was the eternal. He was holy. And that his people also are to become holy. Again, very much a theme we have as we observe the days of unleavened bread. The title I've given to the sermon this afternoon is Like Father, Like Children. It's kind of a play on a familiar cliche or phrase that we use often. Family traits typically are passed along from one generation to the next. And there's a phrase that we often use, usually in kind of a negative way, actually, to dismiss someone or to explain some kind of strange behavior. We'll say, oh, well, like father, like son. Well, in God's case, Israel needed to learn to behave like God. They needed to learn what it meant to be God's nation, just as we need to learn how to be the children of God. The book of Leviticus is about who God is, about how to worship God, and how to live as his children. Learning to be God's people begins with lessons that we learn from the days of unleavened bread. So let's look a little bit at the book of Leviticus. The first 10 chapters deal with offerings and the functions of the priesthood. Frankly, that's about, we get maybe halfway through that section and we kind of fuzz out on the book of Leviticus, because there are all these detailed descriptions of the sacrifices and also the function of the priesthood that are detailed here. We understand, of course, that that whole sacrificial system was a representation of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ that would be fulfilled by him. I'm sure that the people of Israel didn't understand that at all. They really had no idea of the significance of those sacrifices. However, the sacrifices and the priesthood were important to Israel because it provided them with a structured and a formal way to worship God. It gave them things to do that were meaningful, And it was important to them. There was a formality about the priesthood that was intended to be impressive. Aaron and the priests who worked at the tabernacle had very special clothing that they wore that represented their position, their responsibility. These sacrifices and these ceremonies provided that structure and a formal worship of God, and also taught the people to seek forgiveness of sin from God. Now again, I'm sure they didn't really fully understand the implications. Any promises made to Israel were on a physical level, so they wanted to obey God so they could have certain blessings in their lives. But it brought to their attention how serious sin is, and that it needs to be, something needs to be done about it. So those first 10 chapters deal largely with the ceremonies, the sacrifices, and some of the specifics of the priesthood itself. Let's pick up in chapter 11. Leviticus 11 is a chapter that most of us are very familiar with. Probably one of those memory chapters, you know, where it is that God addresses the topic of clean and unclean meats. Well, it's a foundational teaching that was part of God's teaching and part of the structure of his people from then on. And it's introduced in a structured and formal way in the book of Leviticus. There are other scriptures that kind of touch on or hint at, but this is where we find the details. It tells us what we should eat and what we should, what we are not to eat. We're not going to go through the list. I think we're familiar with it. My point is not to go through that particular subject today, but we find it in the book of Leviticus as the people were being taught how to be God's people, what kind of people they must become. Notice the reason that God gave for Israel to follow these dietary laws. Verse 44. Leviticus 11, verse 44. He's talking about what we should eat and not eat, and why it defiles. Certain things would defile them. Why is that important? "For I am the eternal, your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall not, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth, for I am the eternal who brings you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." It's a very basic instruction that establishes the foundation for life for Israel, and frankly, the foundation of life for us. We worship God because of who he is, and we are to be holy because he is holy. Now, certain animals that are prohibited here in this chapter, frankly, are not food. It's not that that's food we can't eat. Those animals are not food, and they're not to be consumed because they aren't healthy, for one thing. But these were animals that were commonly eaten by others, and I'm sure that it was at least some of these were part of the diet of the Israelites when they were in Egypt. But God was making a distinction. What does it mean to be holy? What does it mean to be God's people? We are not to be defiled or contaminated by these unclean animals because God has set us apart for his purpose. Again, he mentions that he is the one who brought them out of Egypt. As the days of unleavened bread are to remind all of us of throughout every generation. Now, the next several chapters here establish various laws of hygiene or quarantine. And again, we would quickly skip over much of this, usually, as we're reading it. But it established some important fundamental principles for the people of Israel. It was teaching them to be considerate of others, to recognize they had a responsibility to other people by the way they handled certain kinds of situations. These chapters deal with hygiene and quarantine, everything from childbirth to leprosy. are dealt with in these chapters. They were learning how to live as a community. They were learning how they should respect one another in various situations so that they would show that that care for one another. Now, our circumstances are different. Some of the application of these certainly applies in principle, and there's nothing wrong with any of those regulations that were placed upon them, but many of them simply are not applicable in our living situation. But they're a part of the teaching to the people of Israel, how to be God's people. Chapter 16 returns to the theme of worshiping God. Leviticus 16 is a very important chapter. We find here a detailed description of how the Day of Atonement was to be observed. It includes certain rituals and ceremonies that were part of the sacrificial system, but it also introduces some symbolism that helps us to understand a very important part in God's plan. Because of this chapter, we understand how Jesus will fulfill the meaning of the Day of Atonement, how he will deal with Satan when Jesus returns. Now, this level of detail, this explanation of symbolism, is not given anyplace else in the Bible. But it was introduced to the Israelites here, so they would recognize their responsibility for sin. Again, they had no idea what the real symbolism was. So this observance was not just for them, it's for us as well. Because we're the ones who understand. We're the ones who are learning how to be the children of God now. And we're given this instruction in the book of, in chapter 16 of Leviticus. Chapter 17, God had made the point, and he does several times throughout the books of Deuteronomy as well as and Leviticus, that we are not to worship our God as the pagans worship their gods. And here is some instruction about the proper handling of sacrifices. Pagans commonly consumed the blood of sacrificed animals. God was teaching his people differently. They were not to eat blood or to consume the blood of the animals when they were sacrificed. There's a good health reason for that, if nothing else. I mean, there are those cultures where people drink the blood of animals. It's kind of a disgusting thought to us. But for the pagans, it was a way of worshiping life, because the blood would bleed out of the animal, and it would lose its life, and it was supposed to transfer the life of that animal somehow into them. That's how they viewed it. That's why they included the consuming of blood as part of their sacrifices. The life of the animal was represented by the blood, but that's exactly why the people of Israel were told not to eat that blood. They also learned that it was by the blood of the animal that atonement for sin could be granted. Drop down to verse 24 here in Leviticus 18. Leviticus 18, verse 24. Do not defile yourselves with any of those things, speaking of the wrong kinds of sacrifices and drinking of blood. For by all these the nations are defiled, which I am casting out from before you. For the land is defiled, therefore I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon the land and vomit out its inhabitants. Now, I'm sorry, I jumped ahead, didn't I, to chapter 18. We're talking about proper sacrificial practices in chapter 17. Chapter 18 is a different subject. I need to back up a little bit. Chapter 18 establishes basic laws of morality that would guide the people of God, the nation of God. Basic laws of morality. Now, we might take most of these for granted, but the people of Israel needed to learn these fundamental principles that would help them to protect their lives and their families. There are regulations or laws here against such practices as incest, homosexuality, bestiality. Those are prohibited among the people of God. Again, commonly practiced in other cultures. But these Israelites were learning to be the people of God. Imagine the perversion and the chaos that would result if this structure were not enforced. Well, frankly, look at the society around us, and we see that there's a lot of tragedy and chaos and confusion and perversion because many of these basic laws are not being followed. Israel was probably familiar with many of these principles already. I don't think they were totally immersed in paganism, but they needed to be taught and reminded of just how God's people would structure their families, how they would behave toward one another in these matters of morality. So again, verse 24 in chapter 18. The Israelites are warned not to defile themselves with any of these, for by these all the nations are defiled, which I'm casting out before you. This was common practice. The violation of these perversions was common practice in the nations. But God's people are not to be like that. God's people are to obey His statutes. Verse 26, you shall keep My statutes and My judgments and shall not commit any of these abominations. Or, as it goes on to explain, God would spew them out of the land as He was going to destroy these other pagan cultures. The point again, God had rescued Israel from Egypt, and now they would be different. Now they would be holy people, separated from the other nations, not to live like others around them. They were learning who their God was and what He required of them, learning to live according to His law. Once again, the basic lessons that we learn as we observe the days of unleavened bread. The thought of God being the one that we worship and obey continues into chapter 19. We read verses 1 and 2 just a little bit ago. We're told to be holy, for I, the Eternal, your God, am holy. Consider for a moment how quickly life had changed for the Israelites. This all took place, this teaching was given to them within the first year after they had come out of Egypt. The changes that came about in their lives must have seemed overwhelming to them. They'd been living in slavery and ignorance for generations. And now within just a couple of months, now they're told they're a holy nation. And a God that they didn't know has taken responsibility for them. And they became responsible to Him. They came out of a culture that worshipped many different gods. And now they were learning that they were the people of the one true God. Chapter 19 almost reads like the chapter that Paul might have written, because it goes through a list of things that we are to be like, or things that we are to do, things that we are to remember. I'm just going to quickly review what is included in this part of this chapter. Verse 3, where Israel was told to revere and honor parents and observe God's Sabbaths. Verse 4, they were told not to worship or to make idols. Verses 5 through 8, they were given more detail about the importance of proper handling of sacrifices. Verses 9 and 10, they were told to show concern and care for the poor by not neglecting their needs. See, these are new covenant concepts, aren't they? These are things that Jesus taught in terms of our relationship and care for one another. but it was to be part of what the people of God were like. It's what their community, what their nation was to be, and how they were to treat one another. Verse 11, not to lie or be unfair or steal from one another. Almost right out of Ephesians 3 or Colossians 3 or Ephesians 5. Verse 13, not to cheat or rob one another. Verse 14, not to taunt or mistreat a person who is physically handicapped. Verse 15, to exercise fair justice. Verse 16, not to be a gossip or to do anything that endangers another person's life. Verse 18, not to seek vengeance against others, not to carry a grudge. And the principle is given here in verse 18, to love your neighbor as yourself. It almost sounds like Paul telling the church to put off the old man and put on the new man. Or Romans 12, where he exhorts the church in how to love and serve one another. So these are some of the principles and teachings that we find just in the first half of this chapter. You can continue on to see the balance of it, and the same theme and thoughts continues about the basic teaching of how to be the people of God. Now, these are things that we've learned. These are things that we practice. And again, things that are part of our obedience to God, putting sin away and being obedient children of God ourselves. It's also interesting to consider that in this chapter, there are 15 times where the phrase is given that God's people are to obey Him because I am the Eternal. Because I am God. 15 times in this chapter, that phrase is repeated. Verse 37, it concludes in this chapter, therefore you shall observe all my statutes and all my judgments and perform them, I am the Eternal. The Israelites were to observe the days of unleavened bread every year as a reminder of this new life that God had brought them into by rescuing them from Egypt. He used unleavened bread as a reminder of their hasty departure so that they would have that symbol that would represent to them not so much sin, that's something that we identify with leaven. To them, it represented their quick departure, that God intervened for them in such a rapid way that they didn't even have time to put leavening in their bread before they were headed out into the wilderness. I've thought about this. You know, God could have decided that since leaven was left out of their bread when they left Egypt, it would be associated with Egypt as we do with sin. God could have prohibited leavening completely. He could have just told his people, you never eat leaven again because it's a reminder of what happened. As it is, we just are asked to put it out of our, or commanded to put it out of our homes, out of our lives, for a week. And then we can go get it again. I know some families, some people who every year, after sunset on the last day of unleavened bread, they go out for pizza. What if you could never have pizza again? Would life be worth living? What if you could never have a donut? Because leavening is something that God uses a symbol of Egypt or a symbol of sin. What if you could never have a proper pancake? Now, maybe some of you had pancakes this week. Those weren't pancakes. We use the phrase so flat as a pancake. You realize that, you know, a proper pancake is really not so flat after all. But some of those Our sheets of rubber that you had this week are pretty flat. So God eliminated, as a reminder of these basic lessons of what Israel was taught when they were rescued from Egypt, a reminder to us every year that by putting leavening out just for a week. Why a week? They left Israel or Egypt on the night of the 15th, and then they didn't have leaven for a week? They didn't put it out of their homes the way we do. They just didn't have it. Maybe it took that long to regrow the cultures and be able to use leavening in the same way that they had before. But at any rate, it's not that difficult, but it's enough to get our attention. It's enough to change our lives enough that it really makes us stop and think. And we can remember that the basic lessons of being the people of God, in our case being Christians, were introduced right here in the book of Leviticus. Now, this is kind of a little bit off the subject, but I find it interesting to consider that the names of the first five books in the Hebrew Bible are the first words of that book. Now, it doesn't always come through to us because the names we have for these first five books are based on the Pentateuch, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew. But in the Hebrew Bible itself, the names of these first five books are the first word of each of those books. We're talking about the book of Leviticus. Well, that's a Greek word. It's based on the tribe of Levi. It had a lot to do with the priesthood. So in the Pentateuch, they called it Leviticus. In the Hebrew Bible, turn to chapter 1, verse 1. The Hebrew Bible, and I won't try to pronounce the Hebrew, but it is the phrase or the word that the Lord called to Moses. The name of the book in the Hebrew means He called. God called, and remember I mentioned how much that often that phrase is used in the book of Leviticus, that the Lord spoke to Moses, and then Moses passed that on to the people. God, when He had Moses up on the mountain, called to him and gave him the information which became the book of Leviticus. Now, maybe it's just a coincidence. Maybe it's not really all that significant. But when God called to Moses, He told him to teach the nation that He had called out of Egypt. And this book speaks to us, we who are called by God to be His people. So the book of Leviticus is definitely written in a special way. It provides foundational instruction to show us, as we've been called, how to live as the people of God. Now, the Apostle Peter reminds us of these very same lessons. So let's turn to the book of 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1. We read verses 1 through 3 on the first day of Unleavened Bread, looking at the promises that we have been given by God's abundant mercy, that all He has provided for us, the living hope that we have through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the inheritance that we look forward to receiving that God has promised to us. Peter goes on in the next few verses 6 through 8 or so, to talk about the trials that we suffer. Even though we have this great hope, Peter acknowledges that for now we suffer trials along the way. The purpose of those trials is to purify our faith, to prepare us to receive that promise of salvation. Still speaking about the promise of salvation in verses 10 through 12, Peter points out that the prophets who wrote about the coming time of a new covenant didn't really understand what they were writing. But God's promises were written down in many cases by the prophets, so that we could understand and benefit. So Peter has been talking here in these first 12 verses about the promise of salvation, the trials we endure on our way to salvation, and the special privilege it is to have that knowledge of God's plan. And we'll pick it up in verse 13. Therefore, okay, we always stop and remember that that's an important word. Based on what we have just seen in verses 1 through 12, with that in mind, Peter says, in effect, what should we do? What does it mean to us? Because of what we know about salvation, and even about the trials we endure along the way, therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. Not a real commonly used phrase in our lexicon. Gird up the... How many times a week do you hear that? Gird up the loins of your mind. Well, it's a word picture, really. It's an idiom in the Greek language or in their culture. It's a word picture of a man gathering the folds of his garment. Men wore the long, almost dress-like garments. And they would tuck those up inside their belt so they could move more freely. And you might do it when it's, you know, time to work or time to do something active. They would get their clothes out of the way by tucking them up into their belt. So the application of that phrase then is to prepare your mind for action. Prepare your mind for action. Because of what we know, because of what we have has been revealed to us of the promise of our trials, of the value of the knowledge we've been given, and how unique and special it is, because of that, prepare your mind for action. A comparable English idiom might be, pull yourself together. You know, gather up your thoughts and be ready to understand and take action yourself. There are other passages in Scripture where we're told to set our minds. In other words, to focus and to determine and to decide to obey God. To think about what you know and be ready to move forward with that. So he says, prepare your mind for action. Be sober and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Being sober, of course, represents exercising sound judgment, thinking clearly, using our minds, again, as we've prepared them for action, and to rest your life fully, or to dedicate yourself completely to the promise that we have that will be fulfilled when Jesus returns. Live completely and entirely for the return of Jesus Christ. That is the focus. That's what we're setting our minds to. That is the preparation that we're making for action, is to focus on that promise that will be fulfilled when Christ returns. Verse 14, as obedient children. You might want to note and even draw a line possibly between the word grace and obedient. You see, God will grant us the promises of salvation by His grace at the return of Jesus Christ. But God's grace does not eliminate the need for obedience. We are to base our lives on the grace of God. We aren't going to earn salvation or earn what Jesus Christ will give to us at His return. But we must be obedient children. Isn't that what the Israelites were taught? Taught to become obedient as the nation, as the people of God. Obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts. Not giving way or living the way that perhaps you used to live. or perhaps the way that you would be living if God had not brought you into this knowledge. We heard this morning about the changes that God expects us to make, the lessons that we learn as we observe these days, and how we examine ourselves and look for ways to become more obedient children. This week focuses us on that directly and specifically, not that it's unimportant the rest of the year. Conforming yourselves, or not conforming yourselves, to your former lust. The word conforming is from a Greek word that means to be shaped by the world. In other words, not allowing the world to dictate to you what you will be like. Paul uses that phrase, that word in Romans 12, verse 2, that we're not to be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. Again, we saw in this phrase, to gird up the loins of our minds, to be mentally ready, to be prepared for action, to be sober-minded, and to not allow the forces and the influences around us the way they used to influence our lives. But, verse 15, as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. So Peter takes this same concept from the book of Leviticus, and he brings it in to our relationship, what we are learning. We're learning the same lessons, the same foundational lessons, building our lives on the same principles and laws that Israel was introduced to in that first year after they were brought out of Egypt. We've been rescued. We've been brought into a new life. And Peter reminds us of something that we have known and that we're practicing. As was said earlier, that we need to learn to think and act like God. To be holy, because our God is holy. Verse 17, and if you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout this, the time of your stay here or your life, in fear. God is certainly our loving and merciful and gracious Father. He's willing to forgive and willing to be patient with us. But don't forget that God is also a judge. God is also going to judge each and every one of us for and by our works, and by our willingness to be conformed to Him instead of being defined by the world, by the perfect standard of His law. And because of that, we live our lives, it says, in fear. Now, the commentaries kind of trip all over themselves trying to explain how that we don't need to be afraid of God, because God is filled with such grace and He's promised us salvation, we saw earlier in the same chapter. Yes, obviously, God doesn't want us to be living in terror of Him, to have a negative kind of fear. But we do need to realize and remember that God will judge us for our works. And God is just. He will apply His law to everyone, to all. So we must truly revere and honor God, have that kind of fear of God, but we also need to recognize how serious sin is. That while we can be forgiven, God promises He does forgive when we confess our sins and come to Him and call upon the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Yes, He does forgive us, but sin jeopardizes our salvation. And I think that's something that certainly catches our attention. And it emphasizes the need for self-examination, for repentance, and for changing the way that we live, of learning how to be the children of God. Verses 18 and 19 bring us back into, again, the Passover lesson. Knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold from your aimless conduct, received from the tradition of your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. The promises that we base our hopes and lives on are only possible because of what Jesus Christ has done for us. And Peter ties together the lesson of the Passover with the lesson of learning to obey, learning to follow, learning to, how to be the people of God, a lesson of the days of unleavened bread. Now back in Leviticus, we left off with chapter 19 or so. I'm not going to take the time to review any more there right now. But you can look at it, and as you go through the remaining chapters, you'll see again more principles and instruction that establish the foundation of Christian life. I don't think it's just happenstance that the only chapter in the Bible that lists all of the holy days is in Leviticus. The Sabbath, the Passover, the annual festivals. They're all listed in chapter 23. There's a chapter that shows how people, a nation, will be blessed for obedience, cursed for disobedience. There are some fundamental and basic principles throughout this book. The message of the book continues to teach us, continues to reach out to us as New Covenant Christians, reminding us of the most basic, fundamental, starting point lessons of Christianity. And the teaching of this pivotal book is wrapped around two principles that we should always keep in mind. We obey God because He is God. The God who rescued us from bondage. And secondly, we obey God because we need to live as God lives. We need to be holy because God is holy. The two most basic and fundamental lessons that form the foundation of our lives, and again, they relate to the Passover, to the days of unleavened bread. Let's read one more passage in Leviticus, back in chapter 22. Leviticus 22, verse 31. Leviticus chapter 22, verse 31. Therefore you shall keep my commandments and perform them. I am the Eternal. You shall not profane my holy name, but I will be hallowed among the children of Israel. I am the Eternal who sanctifies you, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Eternal. As we return in just a few hours to the days of leavened bread, let's remember what we've learned and rehearsed for this last week. We've said repeatedly in the messages you've heard that we have been rescued. We've been removed from a life of ignorant, self-destructive bondage to sin. We've symbolized that lesson by eating the unleavened bread for these 7 days. But even though our diets will return to normal, we know that we must always remain separate from that life of ignorance and sin. Like father, like children, since we are the people of God, we're learning to be holy as our Father is holy.